Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For the first time in decades, California's primary actually mattered. But voter turnout was not as big as expected. Of the almost 18 million Californians who are registered, 8.6 million voted. 2.6 million ballots still need to be counted. On the night before the election, the AP called the election for Hillary Clinton, I should say on the night before the primary, and this was based on interviews with superdelegates. How did that affect voter turnout, and why did the AP make the decision to run the story on the night before California's primary? Joining us to talk about coverage is Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. Hi, Zach. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also discussing the ongoing crisis in Fallujah, which has been under ISIS control for the past 2 years. The UN has revised the number of citizens who are trapped in Fallujah to 90,000, compared with a previous estimate of 50,000. And we're joined to talk about coverage by Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent with The Guardian. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Rose.
It's great to have you back. So as we always do on Friday's roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that was done well this week. So Zach, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
my great work, huh? I thought honestly, I've been absorbed in my own work, so I can really only talk about that. It does appear that there is quite a bit of interest in an Elizabeth Warren potential vice presidential ticket. Clearly, Harry Reid from the Senate Democrats is very enthusiastic about this, based on the reporting the Huffington Post has done. And Warren and Clinton just had a meeting at Clinton's D.C. headquarters this morning. So I think that's it's a pretty interesting development in the Democratic nomination process.
And we will definitely talk about coverage of this later, along with the AP making the announcement on the night before the California primary. I was actually at the Bernie Sanders rally in San Francisco interviewing voters, and it came down in the middle of the rally.
Wow.
Yeah. So we'll talk about that. And then I also want to talk about the coverage now that Elizabeth Warren and Barack Obama have endorsed Hillary Clinton. And what about you, Martin? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought there was a terrific piece in the Washington Post today, and that was a piece that had explored the aftermath of U.S. strikes in Iraq and also in Yemen. Obama's war in both countries in recent months has been about drones and airstrikes and committing as few forces as he can on the ground, and they've been doing everything they can to come up with precision airstrikes. But the Washington Post had a piece today centered on an email that CENTCOM had received from a victim of one of these strikes. Her whole family had been wiped out, and it was just the inevitable human cost of precision warfare. And I thought it was done well, it was crafted well, and it just allowed us to get amongst the victims again, because for so long, especially in recent months, we've been—it's almost been like Game Boy up there with airmen just pressing buttons and explosions down below, and we haven't seen much of the collateral damage. And I think this just brought us right back to the inevitable human cost of war.
Hmm. Martin, can you talk a little bit about how reporters should and can coverage the human cost of war? As someone who is the Middle East correspondent for The Guardian, how do you cover this? How do you find out when these strikes are taking place?
It's been a really difficult thing to do in the war against ISIS because access has been so limited. The answer to how do we to cover the human cost is by being there. But when you can't be there, what do you do? How do you get access to these people? Social media helps us reach out. Facebook and various other things help us reach out as well. I think a long history in the region sort of gives you a sense of what's right and what's wrong, which claims deserve to be reported and which deserve to be discounted. But at the end of the day, we cannot get past the old school model of being there as much as we can. There is no substitute for that, and there never will be. Mm-hmm. So the only real response to how do we cover the human suffering of war is by spending as much time on the ground, standing on the side of the suffering as we can.
And so talk about what it's like to report from Iraq today.
Well, I was last in Baghdad a couple of months ago. I was last in the north of Iraq about 3 weeks ago. And I must say, Baghdad hasn't felt as dangerous as it felt in March at any point since about 2006. It just didn't feel right. It seemed sinister. It felt lethal. There was an elevated kidnapping risk. The streets were not, they didn't seem to be secure. It was more lawless. It was just more dangerous and menacing than it had been for a long time. So what that forced us to do was almost to resort to 2006 protocols. And that was the heart of the sectarian war, where, you know, any checkpoint could have been a compromised checkpoint. It wouldn't necessarily have been run by the state military, so you had to be on high guard all of the time. It was last month or so, it seemed to be a state that was losing its way. The security of the government control just seemed to be drifting. And so that made us just think, well, how do we tell these stories? And you go back to, you don't spend as much time on street corners as you would have otherwise. You're very careful about the interviews that you line up. You need to avoid militias. You need to know where the various front lines are around the city, which checkpoints have been compromised in the past. So all of those things you need to factor up. There are a hell of a lot of variables into making a basic decision in an environment such as that. But you do need to make those decisions. You do need to continue to tell the story. There's no point in going to Baghdad and sitting in a hotel lobby and trying to say that reporting reflects the mood of the city.
You said that it's more menacing and more dangerous today. What explains this?
I think it seems to be the gradual decay of state control. The Prime Minister of Iraq, Haider al-Abadi, has been aggressively pushing a reform program, which is necessary. It must be done. The country has been plagued by corruption, which has eaten away state revenues. Iraq's a country that has gotten by on oil for the last few years. 97% of its economy comes from oil, but with a structurally low oil price, and that not likely to change, they've eaten away their reserves, and so much of the country has been looted and pillaged by those in power. That Abadi, along with the religious authorities in Iraq, have said, well, this has to change. We need to force a new government of technocrats who aren't going to be beholden to people and who can actually deliver services. This has been pushed along by very broad public sentiment, but there has been some significant pushback in the parliament itself by vested interests who stand to lose tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of these reforms are passed. So what we have is a standoff, with state control is being defied by powerful people within the parliament, and on the other side we have a combustible street who's gotten into the green zone, which is the safest area in Iraq where the seat of government stands, and two times in the past 6 weeks they've actually jumped the fence and stood outside the Prime Minister's office. And if we're getting to that in Baghdad, that just shows how state control is starting to crumble.
Talk a little bit about Fallujah, Martin. It's 40 miles west of Baghdad. It's been under ISIS control since early 2014. And in recent months, Iraqi forces, along with Iran-backed militias, have tried to capture the city. And the UN just came out with revised numbers showing that citizens who are trapped in Fallujah now number about 90,000, whereas just a couple days ago, the number was 50,000. How did the situation in Fallujah get so dire?
Well, Fallujah was taken by ISIS 6 months before the fall of Mosul. Mosul was that seminal moment in June, July 2014, where ISIS overran northern Iraq, where the Iraqi military capitulated. And soon we had Mosul, Tikrit, Ramadi, and other towns falling one after the other. And it looked for a while as though Baghdad itself was under significant threat. But go back 6 months, Fallujah had been taken by ISIS. They rode in with their black flags and their pickup trucks, just as they had way back in 2003, 2004. But Fallujah had been more or less besieged throughout all of that time. It has been an epicenter of the Sunni Islamic resistance for the past 13 years. It was a place in which the forerunners to ISIS took up residence, they being Al-Qaeda in Iraq, then the Islamic State of Iraq. And they'd never really left. However, in 2014, at the beginning of the year, they came back with a vengeance. Shortly afterwards, the Iraqi military were able to encircle it. The road to Baghdad was more or less cut. And there were a prolonged series of bombings in Baghdad, which continue until this day. But the decision to try to retake Fallujah spun directly out of the failed reform program. Twice in 6 weeks, as I mentioned, Abadi's green zone had been penetrated by demonstrators, which made his government look ineffective. And the decision to retake Fallujah was taken within 48 hours of the second breach. Abadi was in search of good news, and he moved his forces onto that city. And 2.5 to 3 weeks later, we're still there.
Martin Chulov is Middle East correspondent with The Guardian. We're also joined by Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter with The Huffington Post. And Zach, Iraq is getting some attention in the presidential debates. Bernie Sanders often brought up Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq War, and now Donald Trump is doing that. In fact, Foreign Policy has a story called Trump Plays the Bernie Card on Foreign Policy. Bernie Sanders has hammered Hillary for having bad judgment on Iraq and Libya, and now Trump is using that as his favorite new weapon. How do you think Iraq should be covered in the coming months?
Well, I think one of the more interesting aspects of the Democratic primary has been the degree to which Hillary Clinton has really embraced Obama's domestic policy legacy, while really distancing herself, I think, from the core tenets of his foreign policy legacy. There are a lot of things that Bernie Sanders and other progressives have critiqued about Obama's foreign policy, particularly the drone wars and what's happening in Iraq. But the general approach from Hillary Clinton has been quite hawkish. She has broken with the president, essentially saying that he has not been nice enough to Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the very conservative prime minister of Israel. And she's been supportive of the Iran deal that President Obama has inked, but also suggested that she would like to see more sanctions against Iran, which essentially means that she's not supportive of the Iran deal. So there's been, I think, much more aggressive language from Hillary Clinton. And it's been interesting that Democrats haven't really seemed to latch onto that very much so far in the debate. They really haven't seemed to care. And I think to some extent, progressives who were very critical of the Bush years and Hillary Clinton's vote for the Iraq War under George W. Bush have been frustrated because I think they've been disappointed to some extent by Obama's foreign policy. But it's pretty clear that within the White House that we've had for the past 8 years, Obama was clearly a much more moderate force, much less prone to sort of shoot first and ask questions later. And Hillary Clinton appears to have been a voice for a more aggressive, I believe her team uses the term muscular foreign policy. They prefer that to hawkish, but that's what they mean.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Zach is right. A lot of Democrats and Hillary Clinton supporters are not talking about her foreign policy, but it is getting some attention in the media. About a month ago, the New York Times Magazine had a pretty lengthy piece by Mark Landler called How Hillary Clinton Became a Hawk. He writes, throughout her career, she had displayed instincts on foreign policy that are more aggressive than President Obama and most Democrats. And then just recently, Jeet Heer in the New Republic has a piece called Here Comes Hillary the Hawk. In going after Donald Trump's recklessness, Clinton has also embraced the neoconservative critique of President Obama. What do you think about this, Martin?
I think it's very clear that Hillary has regarded Obama as an idealist on foreign policy in particular. She's more or less stated that, and I think certainly her supporters believe that Obama's fundamental change in posture in the Middle East in particular has been a significant event. We've gone from a position where allies such as Saudi Arabia and the Gulf have been used to the U.S. underwriting the regional security order for more than 70 years. They now know that Obama wants to partner from behind and push them forward. And I've had a couple of conversations with Saudi royalty over the last 2 years in which they've wanted to talk, which is unusual, and all they've done is criticize President Obama's legacy, saying that he doesn't understand the region, that he can't reposture such as that, like that, without any serious consequences. And they have endorsed Hillary Clinton as somebody who understands the region, who understands that U.S. projection as it was under George Bush is something which the region feels a little more comfortable with, as strange as it may seem. So it does. It does seem to me, from my vantage point, that there is, a pretty warm reception party awaiting Hillary Clinton if she does indeed become president. Donald Trump, it must be said, is a much more of an unknown quantity, and people are very wary of what he might bring to the table.
And you're in London right now, Martin. How is Hillary Clinton being covered in the European press?
That's been interesting in the last week or so. I've had more chance to look at the European press than I normally would. It's all been Trump. There's been very little on Hillary. I mean, the fact that she secured the nomination certainly made headline news here. But people have not known what to make of this Trump phenomenon. It has just been, in some ways, a freak show. The coverage of...
did we lose Martin? Martin, are you still with us? Well, I think we lost Martin. Martin was joining us from London. Sorry about his bad line. That's Martin Chulov, Middle East correspondent with The Guardian. And we're also joined by Zach Carter, senior political reporter with The Huffington Post. Just quickly, Zach, before we pivot from foreign policy, what do you think we should expect in the next couple months? How do you think the media should really cover Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and where they stand on foreign policy?
You know, I think these questions are, particularly regarding Trump, actually quite difficult, because Donald Trump is someone who just flagrantly lies all the time. Mm-hmm. To be blunt, he will make a statement about foreign policy or even about domestic policy, and then claim a few days later to have never made the statement. I mean, his claim that he always opposed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, for instance, is just not true. He supported the U.S. invasion of Iraq and then opposed it after it went bad or went poorly. So I think it's really difficult to cover him. Essentially, every time he says something, the media is giving him a mouthpiece and essentially broadcasting something that is often just simply not true. With Hillary Clinton, I think it's quite. I think she's a bit more of a straight shooter, but I do think it's interesting that this in the Trump phenomenon, to some extent, I think, lets Hillary Clinton makes it harder to do substantive critiques of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy, because her opponent is somebody who is just fundamentally untrustworthy, who is saying things that are simply not true over and over again. And the fact that Hillary Clinton can just come out and say something that's not a bald-faced lie seems like like something of an achievement, I think, relative to her opponent. And I think to some extent the Democratic Party has not really thought through what it thinks the Obama legacy on foreign policy ought to be, and is not really sure where it wants to go. It was very clear that Democrats wanted to break with the Bush foreign policy legacy after 2008. But to the extent that Democrats are excited about the last 8 years, they're mostly excited about domestic policy achievements. They really like the Affordable Care Act. They like Dodd-Frank. They think the stimulus was a good idea. There is not the same consensus around foreign policy, what the foreign policy goals ought to be, other than sort of, a general warmth toward the very idea of diplomacy in the Democratic Party. But that doesn't necessarily mean much. I think most voters are still trying to figure out what they want from the next president. And so I think that makes the debate and the discussion surrounding foreign policy with Hillary Clinton particularly complex.
So when Donald Trump lies, how should the media cover him? He is now the Republican nominee. And so from here on out, it's going to be Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I'm thinking it's going to be Donald Trump saying something outlandish, ludicrous, and Hillary Clinton will respond. Elizabeth Warren will respond. Welcome to the next 5 months. How do you think the media should deal with this?
Well, clearly you've seen Elizabeth Warren has really come out and been, I think, really one of the more effective attack dogs that the Democrats have had against Donald Trump on a series of different issues. But I think the media is actually in quite a difficult place, because if they say Donald Trump said X, and X is not true, they're still giving a platform to Donald Trump saying something that is not true.
Talking about it all day long.
Exactly, even if they fact-check it. And so at the Huffington Post, our position has been that when he says something that's not true, we should point out that it's not true. You can read the editor's notes in every single one of our pieces about Donald Trump. It makes very clear what the editorial position is at the Huffington Post regarding Donald Trump, that he is a racist and a misogynist and a xenophobe. That's been quite explicit for us. But it to me, it's not obvious that there's a right way to do this. I think the fact that he is saying things that are just untrue all the time puts reporters in a tough spot. Do you fact check him and thus give him a platform, or do you ignore him? I just don't think there are a whole lot of good options.
Zach Carter is a senior political reporter with the Huffington Post. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. We're going to talk coverage of the California primary. What did you think of the Associated Press announcing that Hillary Clinton is the nominee on the night before the California primary? We talked about massive voter registration in California. Almost 18 million Californians are now registered to vote. Final numbers, 8.6 million actually voted. 2.6 million ballots still need to be counted, and those include vote-by-mail ballots and provisional ballots. There is a lot of misinformation out there. A lot of people were really angry about what went down on Tuesday because of the AP announcement. The LA Times had a good piece about how machines were broken. There was a lot of chaos at polling stations. And so I called the Secretary of State's office yesterday just to get an answer because there was so much misinformation flying around. The provisional ballots will definitely be counted, but it's going to take a long time. The official results will not come down until July 15th. So at this point, California still has 2.6 million ballots to count. 2.6 million. So what are your thoughts about how these issues got covered this week? We'd love to hear from you. And then also at the national level, Barack Obama has endorsed Hillary Clinton. Senator Elizabeth Warren has endorsed Hillary Clinton. And now a lot of people are talking about party unity. What will it take for Bernie supporters to support Hillary? Who's really talking to voters? Are you seeing many interviews with voters? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And I wanted to ask you, Zach, what are your thoughts about the AP's decision to call the nomination for Hillary Clinton the night before California voted? First time in decades that our primary sort of mattered. And TruthDig's Bill Boraski has a piece. And Stephen Olemacher, the AP reporter in charge of tracking delegates, told the Washington Post, quote, "We've been chasing this story for months. We started surveying the superdelegates late last year. We use reporters from all over the country. Mostly it would be state reporters in each state calling the delegates in their states, and some of us in Washington then did a follow-up interview." So what are your thoughts about the AP's decision to do this?
I'm of two minds about the AP's decision. Look, at Huffington Post, we covered the AP's choice and made, I think, we had some very prominent coverage noting that Hillary Clinton was going to be the first woman to be the head of a major party nominee in American history. But I do think the Bernie Sanders campaign has something of a point here in that the superdelegate counts are not official until the convention actually happens. And you were just talking about California's votes being tallied by July 15th. You know, the convention is about a week after that, maybe 2 weeks after. I think it's July 25 is the actual convention date that it begins. So, what the AP is doing is making a projection. They're not saying that Hillary Clinton has secured the nomination. She's not. But Bernie Sanders is somebody who has run his campaign explicitly by attacking the Democratic Party establishment. Superdelegates are the Democratic Party establishment. They're not going to vote for Bernie Sanders. They're going to stick with Hillary Clinton. These are the people that he has been criticizing throughout his campaign. So while I do think that Sanders has a technical point here, I just think it's extremely it is not as though the AP has wildly misled the public and told them that something that is not true. It is the case that the Democratic Party establishment likes Hillary Clinton and that those people are going to support her at the convention should Bernie Sanders choose to stick in things through Philadelphia.
Zach Carter is senior political reporter with the Huffington Post. After the break, we'll also be joined by Brad Friedman, contributor to Salon and creator of the Brad blog. We will be talking about a lot of the voting problems that we saw in California and across the country. You have to wonder why these issues are not getting more attention. Machines were broken. Some polling places opened late. There was a lot of confusion about no party preference voters, not just on the part of voters, but also polling workers. So what are your thoughts on coverage of that issue? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion yet or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half hour here on KALW, it's Inflection Point.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will have a conversation about Lyme disease. This is getting a lot of attention right now in California. What do we know exactly about Lyme disease? Every year, more than 300,000 Americans are diagnosed with this disease. And if it's not treated, it can result in fever, rash, facial paralysis, and arthritis. I have a few friends with this, and it's really, really awful disease. So what do we know about this? What are the best ways to treat it? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. And now we're talking about the California primary, voting problems, and then we'll also talk about what's happening at the national level. Who's really talking to voters about where they stand? We're joined by Zach Carter, senior political reporter with the Huffington Post. And now I'd like to welcome Brad Friedman, a frequent contributor to Salon and Truthout, the creator of thebradblog.com and host of KPFK Pacifica Radio's The Bradcast. Hey, Brad, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back. Brad, your website is fantastic when it comes to voting problems. And I wonder how you think the media should deal with an issue like voting problems at a time when so many people mistrust the system. The LA Times deserves a lot of kudos. They had a piece called "It Was Just Chaos. Broken Machines, Incomplete Voter Rolls Leave Some Wondering Whether Their Ballots Will Count." Obviously, this piece was based on fact, but at a time when people don't trust what happened on Tuesday, how should the media deal with this?
Well, you know, the media should always report what they see. They should report accurately, no matter what the effect is, obviously, on the electorate. Now, that said, I don't think that piece in the LA Times was that good, actually, when they described it as just chaos. In fact, their article quoted one person at one polling place who felt things were chaotic. In fact, it was not just chaos, at least according to that particular report. Now, since then, other reports have come in and did continue to come in throughout the day about a confusion at a number of poll sites. But because the LA Times and other media don't bother to report on elections throughout the rest of the year, they don't seem to really understand what the real problems are. For example, one of the problems they reported down here in Los Angeles County was about the ballot readers, the electronic op scanners that ballots are put through in Los Angeles County at the polling place. And a lot of those machines broke down, didn't work on election day. That's bad. But what the LA Times didn't explain is that those machines don't actually count anybody's votes. The only reason they're there in the precinct, essentially, is to let the voter know if they overvoted on a particular race, if they voted too many times, you know, they voted for two different candidates in a race when they're only allowed to vote for one. And it's supposed to reject the ballot under that case and let them know that, hey, you might want to, you know, void your ballot and try again. That's it. When those machines don't work, it doesn't affect anybody's counting. Those ballots are not counted at the precinct. They're sent to the central headquarters. They're counted later. Again, by an optical scan system that may or may not count them correctly. We don't know. Nobody knows unless you bother to count the ballots by hand. But I think that it would have helped the voters down here quite a bit if LA Times and other media had understood how this system worked and said, hey, look, people, if that machine at the precinct doesn't work, your vote is not being suppressed. You just don't get to use the overvote counter. Your ballot will still be counted. There was a lot of people who were very upset who thought their ballot didn't count, that
right.
Their ballot wouldn't be counted because of those machines. And that's not great reporting.
And I think that's why the media plays such an important role during an election, because with social media, I mean, I saw people walking into ballots with their video on their phone working in real time. And one guy, he was voting electronically, and he hit Bernie Sanders, and another name popped up. Well, you can imagine that got shared tens of thousands of times, and people say, see, this just proves that the system is rigged. So it seems like the media needs to step in and look at the facts, interview people, and let the citizens know exactly what's happening.
Give it the proper context, understand what it is they are reporting on, and again, because they don't report on the way our electoral system works, they don't report on it until, you know, the day before, the day of, maybe the day after these elections. They don't really understand it. And so people can get out there with the, you know, wildly inaccurate ideas about what is going on.
Right.
And at the same time, it's left to the people, like you say, to report what's going on. And the people should be able to oversee their own elections and report what is actually going on. Because that's the only way we can have, a legitimate election that the people can have confidence in. But the media has been misreporting so much of this. I heard your conversation before the break there with Zach about AP and their call early in the week that Hillary had won. And they did. I'll have to disagree with Zach on this one point. They did misinform the public. They did announce that Hillary will be the first female nominee from a major political party. And the fact is, as of Monday night, when they reported this, they absolutely could not know that was the case. And that way, you know, they were guessing. That's fine. If they want to predict, that's one thing. But had they reported it, if the convention were held today, she would have enough delegates to win the nomination. That's one thing. But that's not how they reported it. They reported it that she will be the Democratic nominee. And this was on a day before some, 18 million voters in California alone, not to mention the five other states, had even cast their votes yet. I find that reprehensible, irresponsible, and a violation of the media's duty to inform the electorate, not to misinform the electorate.
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line who want to weigh in on this. Let's go to Josh in Sunnyvale. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Great. I think the Democratic Party has really shown that they're not going to allow Bernie to become the nominee. They're fighting every way they can, dirty. And I think that the Bernie or Bust movement is so strong now, I think he should direct all his attention to joining the Green Party and run as an independent candidate.
Well, thank you for calling, Josh. Zach, what are your thoughts about this? We keep hearing from the Dems that they need party unity now. I'm not seeing many interviews with voters, and I'm here in Washington, D.C. Bernie Sanders had a rally last night, and I went to interview voters because I thought, well, who's going to show up? What are they thinking right now? And they sounded just like Josh. I mean, a lot of these voters, a wide cross-section, young, older, very diverse group of people said, I'm either voting green or I'm undecided. I'm not really hearing from them in the media.
I think it's really interesting. For the first time in, certainly since I've been covering elections, which goes back to 2008, you get the feeling that there is a significant movement of the party's base away from where party leaders seem to be. Bernie Sanders is not going to be the Democratic Party nominee. Your caller is correct about that. But it's still the case that there are a lot of people who have been very excited by his movement. And I think it's particularly interesting that young people have been so drawn to his message because, look, edgy, hip kids do not go around looking for white-haired socialists from Vermont who are 74 years old when they want to show each other how cool they are. What's happened here is that you have a whole generation of people who came of age politically during the Great Recession. And the economic fundamentals of the United States economy are such that people who have been watching establishment politics for the last 30 years are not happy with the way the economy works. And until the economy fundamentally changes, those people are not going to support the Democratic Party policies of the 1990s, or even, I think a lot of Democrats do like Obama's domestic policy legacy, but there are a lot of things about it they don't like, right? The Affordable Care Act has been, a significant accomplishment, but we still have, 30 million people who don't have health insurance in the United States right now, and young people in particular face an unemployment rate that's more than double what the national average is. So it's just very difficult to be a young person in today's economy right now. And that's not going, those people aren't going to go away. Hmm. They're going to be part of the Democratic Party, and they're going to be a major voice within the Democratic Party for years to come.
And just based on the rallies that I've been to interview people in Oakland, San Francisco, and Washington, yes, a lot of young people are there, but I'm also meeting a lot of older people, a lot of women, I mean, people from across the spectrum. And Brad, what do you think about how this should be covered from here on out? Because once D.C. votes next Tuesday, that's the last city to actually vote, what happens to this movement and what, you know, people going to these rallies? I mean, in California, it was, what, 250,000 people went to about 32 Bernie Sanders rallies. And Matt Taibbi has a piece in Rolling Stone called "Democrats Will Learn All the Wrong Lessons from Brush with Bernie," saying that voters are trying to express their frustrations through this campaign, but he writes, party leaders have been and probably will continue to be too dense to listen. It's time to stand in line, is basically what he's saying.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not the type of reporter that predicts what's going to happen, because I've seen those reporters tend to get it wrong. They've gotten it wrong all cycle long. As far as, you know, who's going to be the Republican nominee, they completely ignored Donald Trump early on. They thought he was a joke. We didn't. We reported that he was not being taken as a joke. So I'm very careful about predictions. What's going to need to happen, though, if the Democratic Party wants to pull in all of those Bernie voters, is they're going to have to figure out how to reach out to those folks. You know, there's talk, obviously, of Elizabeth Warren on the ticket as vice president. That would certainly go a long way, I suspect, as far as bringing in Sanders voters. And it's also going to be up to Bernie Sanders, what he wishes to do, you know, what he wishes to tell his supporters and how they should move forward. So we don't know how that's all going to play out. Right now, the election is still ongoing. There is a primary contest on Tuesday in Washington, D.C. The voters of Washington, D.C. have a right to express their voice. Yes, there are 20 delegates available are not going to flip the pledged delegate counts, but those people still deserve to have a voice. And then beyond that, you know, I was critical about AP. Well, when AP made that call, it was almost 2 months from the convention itself. Now, short of Bernie Sanders saying, I'm getting out, I'm not going to Philadelphia, I'm not going to challenge anything in Philadelphia, short of that, we don't really know what's going to happen on July 25 when those superdelegates finally cast their vote. None of them have voted yet. So I don't know why there's such a rush. You know, again, Zach said Hillary's going to be the nominee. Well, that's certainly the likelihood at this point, but we don't know that. So why would we want to put our thumb on the scale before the process has played out? It's democracy. Let it play out. What's the rush to declare someone the winner or the loser, you know, before votes are counted, before people have even voted? I really don't understand that. 2.5 million votes still left to be counted out here in California, and a lot of them, by the way, provisional ballots. Why were there so many provisional ballots cast all across California, particularly down here in Los Angeles County? I've been talking to the LA County Registrar about this over the last, well, it's a blur now, what, 2 or 3 days since the election. And there's a lot of troubling stuff that appears to have gone on that has forced people to vote provisionally. Right. We ought to be focusing on that instead of, you know, what's going to happen 2 months from now at a convention that we are just guessing about at this point.
Well, and to that point, we have an email from Robert who says, you just stated that more than 2 million California voters have yet to be counted, but the New York Times and others are reporting that 100% of the vote has been counted. Yes, Robert, you're right. I called the Secretary of State's office yesterday because there was so much confusion around this. There are more than 2.5 million uncounted mail-in ballots and provisional ballots. They have to be certified, those provisional ballots. That's going to take a long time. And there are actually people at San Francisco City Hall who are watching this process. And the state is not going to certify the campaign, the election, until July 15th. So 2.5 million ballots at this time are uncounted in California. And Brad, it's pretty confusing because Robert is right. If you look at election results, it says 100% of the precincts have been counted.
Right. It is confusing. And 100%, so when they're talking about the precincts being counted, they're talking about the votes that were cast on election day by the normal system. They're not talking about provisional ballots that people were forced to vote. They're not talking about vote-by-mail ballots that people delivered to the precinct on election day. They're not talking about vote-by-mail ballots that were sent as late as election day, June 7th. Those are still coming in, still need to be processed, and will continue through the end of this week. So it's horribly misleading. I don't know why they don't understand their job is to inform the electorate. Instead, they seem their job is to announce who won and who lost. They often do this, you know, on election night. We've seen it throughout the cycle. The polls will close at 8 o'clock, and at 8 o'clock and 1 second, CNN will declare such and such the winner before a single vote has even been tallied. I don't get that. Why won't we count the votes of the people? That seems to be what the media does. It's a race to be first to make some pronouncement. They don't give a damn if they get it wrong and they have to change it later, or if it disrespects people who are still standing in line waiting to cast their votes after the polls have closed. But that's what they do. It's just a horrible, this horrible coverage of the most central part of our system of governance. It's democracy. And it's been terrible. It's been terrible for years. I've been covering, as you know, Rose, I've been covering elections now for well over a decade. And arguably, it is getting worse, not better, in the media. The good news is there's the social media out there, and the people are understanding their responsibility more in overseeing elections. They're doing a better job of that. However, there's such bad reporting in the media that what happens is in social media, you have people who see something go wrong and they declare it is fraud and they declare it's Hillary Clinton defrauding the system. Well, it's not necessarily evidence of fraud. It's certainly not evidence of Hillary Clinton having anything to do with it. So we've got this sort of wild, wild west. We've got all of this confusion. We've got all of this chaos, and we don't have a corporate media out there who is trying to tamp it down by actually letting the electorate know what is actually going on. And it's very frustrating for me and certainly for millions of voters in this country.
Right. Zach, what are your thoughts on that? How does the Huffington Post deal with these issues, voting problems, what happens at the polls, the need to get it first? Because Brad's right. I mean, there's a lot of anger on social media. How does the Huffington Post deal with this?
You know, we don't really, we're not in the business of calling elections, so we effectively go with what the major networks are doing. So when the major networks and AP decide that somebody has, that they're comfortable calling a state for a candidate, we will report that these networks have done this. I think Brad's point that, you know, when people call a state before the polls are closed while people are still waiting in line, I think that is pretty obnoxious. But it's also just, I haven't seen anything this cycle, and I could be wrong. You know, people could, this could have happened and I could have missed it. But I haven't seen a whole lot of inaccurate reporting on states being called incorrectly for people. I haven't seen people be misinformed by that. But I do think Brad's got a point. You know, if people are standing in line to vote, let them cast their votes before you make a call on the state. It'll be okay if you say it in another half hour. That'll be fine.
Zach Carter is senior political reporter with the Huffington Post. Brad Friedman is creator of the Brad Blog, a contributor to Salon, and he hosts Pacifica Radio's The Bradcast. And we have another email from Mary who says, we talk about how important the young voters are to Bernie, for example, yet they didn't show up to vote in California. Why? Is this because the AP called the election for Hillary the night before? I guess we'll never know, but what are your thoughts, Zach?
I mean, look, I think the Bernie Sanders campaign has a legitimate grievance here about the AP calling this, and particularly the way that the AP's call has been covered. Brad's right. It's just not the case that the superdelegates count until the actual day of the convention. I do think that later on in a race, when it becomes clear that one candidate is going to win and not another one, it is harder to motivate the losing candidate's supporters. I think Bernie Sanders' campaign, if you talk to his campaign people, they will say that one thing that they've been worried about is, you know, they want to get every vote counted, but it is harder to inspire people when it becomes pretty clear that the other candidate has a significant lead in delegates and that you're not going to be able to get a majority of delegates before the convention. And in fact, his campaign strategy now rests on the idea that he would be able to wrest these party insiders away from supporting Hillary Clinton. So that's just a tough message to sell to people. And you know, we saw this in the 2008 primary as well, when Hillary Clinton was running against Barack Obama, and it was very clear that Barack Obama was going to win. It was harder for Hillary Clinton to inspire her supporters to come out to come out and vote as the election wore on.
Zach, how do you plan to continue covering this movement? In one of your recent pieces, you write, "Will the campaign matter in defeat? No. Bernie Sanders did not create the movement that political pundits like to credit him with. He has instead spent a year serving rather effectively as the voice of people left behind by a broken economy. Until that economy is fixed, the movement will not go away, no matter who rises to lead it."
I agree with what I said. I think... particularly in D.C., it's been really easy for people. People have a sort of a top-down view of politics in D.C. because, of course, they're around people who are actually in politics, and people like to think that, you know, they're important and their decisions matter. But I think for the most part, at least what's happening in the Democratic Party, and I think you can see this to a significant extent in the Republican Party with the popularity of Donald Trump, you have a bottom-up reality. What happens is that there are actually voters out there who have legitimate policy grievances, who want to see certain types of policy enacted, and Bernie Sanders did not demagogue his way into prominence among these people. He did not just start making stuff up and get these people to like him. He was listening to people, and the stuff that he said is stuff that people agreed with. They're not just gonna forget all of that, you know, in the middle of November. Those concerns and those worries are still going to be with us next week, next month, next year. And I think you can see this with what Hillary Clinton is doing with Elizabeth Warren. I mean, I think that's a pretty smart tactical move by her camp. You know, I think to no small extent here, Bernie Sanders is just sort of the guy who was willing to get in the ring, right? There are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who wanted to see Elizabeth Warren run for president, and she didn't. And so Bernie was sort of like, all right, well, there's somebody here who's willing to run. He's saying basically the same things Elizabeth Warren has been saying for several years. And Clinton has been running as she's been calling herself a practical progressive for several months now. Well, she has an opportunity to really prove that to people. If she really doesn't think there's a whole lot of policy distance between herself and Bernie Sanders, then naming somebody like Elizabeth Warren to be your vice president is a good way to show voters that. And I think there are a lot of voters who are, you know, maybe not super enthusiastic about voting for Hillary Clinton, who would be very, very happy to vote for Elizabeth Warren. And so if you're talking about party unity, this is the sort of thing that's got to come from the victor. You know, the loser isn't the person who can unite the party. It's got to be coming from the winner.
Well, thank you again for the email, Mary. Let's go to our next caller. We have time for a few more. Phil in Santa Cruz. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Yes. Excuse me a second. I got to turn this machine off. Yeah, the corporate mainstream media, and that includes PBS and NPR, by the way, has never been comfortable with the democratic socialist message of Bernie Sanders because it threatens the status quo that they clearly benefit from. This negative bias in of Bernie Sanders' campaign has been obvious just simply by observing of what they've chose to underreport or downplay. So that said, the AP and NBC declaring Hillary the winner the day before the largest primary in the country is media manipulation, and it smacks of collusion between the corporate media and the Democratic Party elites. The press is supposed to report the news, not make it. And we'll never know how many people stayed home and didn't vote because of this act of collusion. The Associated Press is, frankly, in my opinion, has inflicted egregious and irreparable harm on our democracy and the credibility of their press. So that's my message for today. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Phil. You might want to check out that Truth Dig piece by Bill Boraski. He reached out to the AP. He's got a list of questions that he wanted to ask them. Why run this story at this crucial moment? What was the news organization thinking? Did AP consider the impact on the election? But he hasn't received a phone call back, so you might want to check that out. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to Don in Berkeley. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for doing the show. I have a couple of quick points. The quote, movement behind Bernie has not disappeared. In fact, there will be a people summit in Chicago from June 16th to 18th. People should just go to the website, peoplesummit.com. The second point is, if people are really frustrated with the way elections happen in this state, there's a group called the Voting Rights Task Force in the East Bay that focuses on these issues, and the best way to get in touch with us is at countedascast.org. The third point I would make, and by the way, thank you for having Brad on. He's fabulous on these issues, is the media, you know, we keep talking about the media being corporate. Well, what does that really mean? It means that they really don't cover news, potential news, proactively way before the problem's going to happen. Brad knows, and those of us involved in the voting rights and voting and election integrity movement know, that voting is chaotic in this country at best, number one. And number two, the machines that people are using still, they're getting old. There's no plan in place to provide the monies to actually move toward a non-electronic voting machine system. In other words, getting away from black box voting. Because, you know, Brad...
Don, sorry to cut you off, but we're almost out of time, and I just want to get a response from Brad. So what is the media, once again, I mean, look at 2000, what do they learn from this? When I called the Secretary of State's office yesterday, I said, are you going to have a press conference or something to talk about what happened on the primary and to talk about what needs to be done to ensure this doesn't happen again? And they said, well, we don't have anything planned. So, Brad, what are your thoughts about what the media should learn from all these problems and the tough questions they should be asking the people who make these voting decisions?
The media has learned absolutely nothing in the past decade about this system, period. And the fact that we have a Secretary of State who hasn't come out, who hasn't bothered to inform the state about, you know, not only the problems that were had on Election Day, but the concerns prior to Election Day. And there were a lot of them. And Secretary of State Padilla did not come out and did not, you know, try to help California understand when we have an incredibly, ridiculously, stupidly complicated system, 7 different parties, 10 different ballot styles, more than 12 different languages, 18 million voters, and there was very little done to inform the voters. They, you know, faced some chaos, and he has a responsibility to speak to it. The L.A. County Registrar told me that we have a system. He told me this just days ago. We have a system that is largely designed for chaos by the legislature, by the state legislature, and the media is simply not informing the public about how it works and how it doesn't. They're misinforming the public. There are electronic voting system problems all over the country. We will never know who won Kentucky. We will never know who won Missouri during this primary cycle because of the 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems used in those states and the closeness of the elections. And the American people have absolutely no idea about any of that. And it is maddening, and it is a disservice to the Republicans, to the Democrats, to the independents, to the voters, and to democracy itself.
Well, we'll continue covering this. We have a bunch of emails about the no-party preference confusion. We did a lot of shows about it, and we'll definitely continue covering that. Brad Friedman is the creator of the Brad Blog, a contributor to Salon and host of Pacifica Radio's The Bradcast, and Zach Carter is a senior political reporter with The Huffington Post. Brad and Zach, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, and thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about Lyme disease, which is transmitted to humans through the bites of infected ticks. Every year, more than 300,000 Americans are diagnosed with Lyme disease. Untreated diseases can produce a wide range of symptoms, including fevers, rash, facial paralysis, and arthritis. So how much is known about Lyme disease? What are the best ways to treat it? Join the conversation with Renee Kemp and you.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma went searching for the greatest musicians on the planet. Together, they formed the Silk Road Ensemble.
For me, the idea is to develop enough technique so that you could use that technique to explore.
Yo-Yo Ma on the new film about his Silk Road Ensemble later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, 3 o'clock this afternoon here on 91.7 KALW.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, the workers from Donald Trump's hotels hit the campaign trail. But are they for him or against him?
Well, I can say to Mr. Donald Trump, you know, he's running for president. He's trying to make America great. So he can start with us, start negotiating our contract. You know, he can start that way.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Latino USA coming up in just an hour at 2 hours at 1 o'clock. here on KALW San Francisco. Right now it's 11.
Welcome to Inflection Point, conversations with women changing the status quo. I'm Lauren Schiller. Today on Inflection Point, will the debate over reproductive rights ever end?
It is a clash of worldviews. And on one side, you have people who genuinely believe that women should be trusted and respected to make our own decisions. And on the other side, you have people that have a very narrow view of what women's role is and what family looks like.
And what's the most expensive disease you've never heard of?
Endometriosis in the United States puts a burden on society of $119 billion annually.